Blog Talk Radio.
I want to thank Brother Jesse Gray, for the invitation to come here this afternoon and participate in this rally, which I believe is for the good of the community, the good of the black community. And anything that's good for the black community, the white man should realize it is good for his community. Jesse Gray is one of the key persons in the Harlem area, primarily because he's dealing with one of the key problems, the problem of housing. It doesn't make any difference what else you have. If you don't have some place to rest your head, you're in bad shape. Here in Harlem, the reason we say that housing is such a key problem, when you live in a poor neighborhood, you're living in an area where you have to have poor schools. When you have poor schools, you have poor teachers. When you have poor teachers, you get a poor education. And when you get a poor education, you are destined to be a poor man and a poor woman the rest of your life. Poor education, you can only work on a poor paying job. And that poor paying job enables you to live again in a poor neighborhood. So it's a very vicious cycle. And usually these bad housing conditions result from the fact, as Mr. Gray has pointed out, of absentee landlords, people who are rich and live downtown and let you and I live up here in the shack. Actually, it's a form of 20th century slavery. And what you and I have to let the man know is we are peaceful people. We are loving people. We love everybody who loves us. But we don't love anybody who doesn't love us. We're nonviolent with people who are nonviolent with us. But we are not nonviolent with anyone who is violent with us. Once those intentions are made known, we can get to the nitty-gritty of the problem. We can get to the core of the problem. We can get to the root of the problem. And then we can correct the problem. There's been a lot of talk said recently because I was supposed to have said something about Negroes should buy rifles. White people have been buying rifles all their lives. No commotion. I see an editorial right here in a paper they call the Journal America. One that we happen to have sued against for around $6 million for saying the wrong thing a few years ago. It says that we're supposed to be organizing some kind of Negroes to arm themselves with rifles and shotguns for self-defense. America is based upon the right of people to organize for self-defense. This is in the Constitution of the United States. You read it for yourself. Brother James had the Constitution. He brought the Constitution in with him. I don't know why. What is that now? What article is that? The Second Amendment to the Constitution spells out the right of people under this particular governmental system to have arms to defend themselves. All of you know I'm not an integrationist. I'm a believer in the Honorable Elijah and follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. I'm still a Muslim. My religion is Islam. I run into some obstacles in the Nation of Islam, and I feel that I can best serve the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's purpose and program and carry into existence what I feel, I understand, concerning his objectives better on the outside than I can on the inside. And now that I have the independence of action, it's my intention to work with everybody or against everybody, whatever the case may be, to try and get some kind of immediate solution to the problems that are confronting our people. I still believe the best thing for us to do is go back home to Africa. But while we're getting ready to go back, we've got to eat now, we've got to sleep now, we have to have some clothes now, our children have to go to school, and we need some place to work. So whatever kind of action program can be devised to get us the things that are ours by right, then I'm for that kind of action no matter what the action is. I don't think when a man is being criminally treated, that some criminal has the right to tell that man what tactics to use to get the criminal off his back. When a criminal starts misusing me, I am going to use whatever is necessary to get that criminal off my back. And the injustice that has been inflicted upon Negroes in this country by Uncle Sam is criminal. Don't blame a cracker in Georgia for your injustices. The government is responsible for the injustices. The government can bring these injustices to heart.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Moore's Talk Live 100. I'm your host. And today's broadcast will be Moors, Americans, Moorish Americans, and guns. And what we're trying to discover here is whether or not people of African descent inside the United States are Moors. Should have weapons. And we want to look at the record and gather all the facts and look at the overall conditions of what's going on inside the United States to make a solid decision in regards to whether or not that we should have weapons. And if so, should we train our women and children to use them for protection? Should we use them for hunting and gathering of food? What type of weapons we should have, and what type of, how much ammunition and all this, and we're going to try to cover this this evening in this particular broadcast. First of all, let me say that we are offering our usual articles, the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game, and the way you get that is simply by contacting me at tahaka99@yahoo.com. That's tahaka99@yahoo.com, and I'll send that to you as an email attachment. Now, I've been locked out on Facebook, so I haven't been sending out any friend requests, and they've blocked me in, put me on a 30-day suspension because they claim that I'm doing something wrong. But the only thing that I'm guilty of is befriending my own people, and most of them are Moors that have the same last name as I. So I don't see what the problem is. I haven't had anybody complain against me for just asking them for friendship. But needless to say, the powers that be decided that I was causing the problem, and I guess it probably is because of the truth that I tried to tell on these broadcasts and posts. So if you have a friend request, go ahead and send it to me, and I'll go ahead and grant it, but I cannot send out any. I have to receive them and grant them, and so just keep that in mind. Also, we've created one of the most comprehensive libraries in the country, and the way you access that is by telephone. Just contact me at area code 904-303-9061, and we'll get that to you. Also, I want to make a brief mention of the Moorish American National Government. The brothers and sisters will be pulling out to Geneva, Switzerland very, very soon. And but we're still hosting the live conference calls that take place 7 days a week and at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And on Wednesday night, the Grand National Chairman is teaching, and that number is 760-569-7100, and the access code is 437-966-pound. And the ladies are on Tuesday night. Their number is 218-862-1442, and the access code is 101-5555-pound. And you can get on there and just start fix your phone if you got any questions or comments. And tonight, if you got any questions or comments, just follow the prompts on your phone, and we will open up the lines. But I'm going to go ahead on and get into the broadcast. And we're going to see what is the current attitude today inside. We're going to look at listen to a little quick, brief news announcement, and then we're going on to the talk shows and see how these people are responding to people of African descent in this country today in the 20th century. Okay? So just sit back and we'll go ahead with this.
A neo-Nazi killing spree. Excuse me, the targets, dozens of African Americans. The ultimate goal, killing Barack Obama. Federal investigators say that was the twisted fantasy of two young men now in custody. The 20-year-old Tennessee man and his 18-year-old pal from Arkansas are being held without bond. Police say they planned to wear tuxedos while they killed and beheaded dozens of people. The Secret Service says there was not any formal assassination plan and would not comment on how credible the threat really was. Obama's campaign has had no immediate comment on the arrests.
Okay.
said what you said. You just said, I don't sit with monkeys. You think because she's black, because I'm black, we're monkeys? Is that?
That's a proven fact.
That's a proven fact? It's a proven fact that I'm a monkey?
Could be. No,
no, go ahead.
First thing I want to get off my mind, okay?
No. I want to talk about the monkey business.
Report.
I want to talk about...
Well, yourself, right? Okay. So now that we gather a little information on the prevailing attitude inside the United States, my position is far as guns are concerned, I own guns, and I don't use them unless I have a target to shoot at. The weapons that I have in my possession are for my own personal protection and the protection of my family, as well as if I need to, if the day comes where I need to hunt for food, I have enough weapons and enough ammunition. And for every weapon that I have at least 7 boxes of ammunition for each weapon, an abundance of ammunition. That way, I am fully equipped for to protect myself. And we do know that the self-preservation is the first law of nature. So it behooves us, to, regardless of what we believe or what we think, we do live in a society that is a armed society. And the people of Caucasian descent are gun lovers. They have plenty of them. And so I don't see no need for a person to be a victim when they are able and equipped to defend themselves. Now, I'm going on, and that is just my position. I just wanted to state that. But we're going to hear from different people this evening in regards to the treatment of people in this country of African descent. And after this broadcast is over, I'm hoping to do the whole thing here, but if we don't, we will have part two. And you can make a decision for yourself based on the information that you hear this evening. Okay?
Have a seat. Thank you. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
This is Khalid Muhammad, former national representative of Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam. Mr. Muhammad is the man who made so many of the front pages of America's newspapers with a speech at Kane College, which so many people called anti-Semitic and a lot of things, at the very least racist. You remember the comment? He picked up the Pope's dress, and let's see what's under that dress. Here's what you said about Colin Ferguson, the man who shot a Jamaican, African, a black male who shot 6 people on the Long Island train. Mr. Muhammad speaks.
Where they set black inmates up in these jails and penitentiaries, and in particular there in Nassau County, and pulled all the black officers out and the black inmates so they could jump on Brother Colin Ferguson because they were mad with him for catching the Long Island train and killing all them white folks. I love Colin Ferguson. I have no official position, so I can say I love him.
You love a man who randomly killed 6 people on a commuter train?
I love Colin Ferguson just as much as the masses of white Americans love General Schwarzkopf, General Westmoreland, General Patton, General MacArthur, and Eisenhower. America awards her killers, and they get ribbons and stripes and bars. I'm sensitive to the pain and suffering of the loss of life on that train. But I'm one of the rebellious. Lift up the skirt again. I don't believe you're missing what I'm saying.
Well,
lifting up the skirt again. Lift up the skirt again. I don't believe you're missing what I'm saying.
Well,
lifting up the skirt again, as the scripture says, raising the skirts of the garment. I'll say it once more for you, and only once more. Has to do with revealing the history, the hidden
get him to the Greek.
Lift up the skirt again. I don't believe you're missing what I'm saying. Lifting up the skirt again, as the scripture says, raising the skirts of the garment. I'll say it once more for you, and only once more, has to do with revealing the history, the hidden history. When you lift up someone's garments, then you show their shame. You show up their private parts, that which they normally hide from the rest of the world. I'm not dealing with organs under the garment. I'm dealing
just
with the organ
parts
of slavery and those parts that have been kept private from the masses of the people.
We are in New York City with Khaled Muhammad, and we'll be back in just a moment. Here is just one of the comments that provoked the Anti-Defamation League to take out a full-page ad in the New York Times and other newspapers. What the ADL did essentially was publish in the New York Times some of the things that you said. Here's a part. This is an audio tape of...
And now, our feature presentation.
We saw that several years ago, and I don't want to see that happen again. It's going to benefit no one. Khalid and I both were shot by black men, but that does not make the black man the enemy. Any more than if we were shot by white men, would it make the white man the enemy? Our enemies cannot be recognized by their state of color, but rather their state of mind. All black men do not think alike, any more than white men think alike. We are all different. God, in His divine plan, has made us individuals. We have the right of freedom in this country. And I would like to see it flourish rather than die. Never in the annals of human history has so few done so much so often to take so much and hurt so many as the warlords of Washington and Wall Street. There isn't anything that you have or ever had or ever hope to have that they're not planning on taking away. They want it all. And they intend to get it all. Khalid says that the white man is the enemy. But I say, he is in part right. It is not the white man that is the enemy, but it is certain white men. All right, now, if somebody has a problem in telling the difference, then they need to get educated. Am I your enemy because I am white? Am I your enemy because I tell you the truth? I take a look at the chart of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission. This is mainly made up of white men. If I take a look at David Rockefeller, I take a look at Henry Kissinger and George Bush and Comrade Clinton. They're all from the same organization, the Council on Foreign Relations. 30 years ago, I produced these albums called the Illuminati CFR, 1967. From these albums came a number of books. None dare call it conspiracy. That particular book is put out at this present time by the Honorable Louis Farrakhan, a man who I happen to respect, a man who has got the message, a man who... like Malcolm X, has discovered that it is not the white man that is the enemy, but certain white men. And I think that there is a widening difference between Khalid Muhammad and Louis Farrakhan, and I'm going to discuss that difference in a moment. When Khalid talks about killing the white man, killing the mothers and the sisters, the brothers, the babies and grandma and the cripples, and burying them and digging them up and killing them again. That is the talk about a black bigot. We're talking about, at least I'm talking about, America's black Hitler. And I think he deserves that title. Racism can be exploited. And I believe Khalid Muhammad is exploiting that. See, we have an opportunity to change things around. We have an opportunity to incite a revolution, to avoid a revolution. This is an awakening, and this awakening must happen. Because when I say they intend to kill you, I'm talking about this cashless cartel, I'm not kidding.
Are they white?
Yes, they are white. There is no question that the enemy in this country is white. And we have to recognize it. But it is not the white man collectively. It is certain white men. The Central Intelligence Agency is the control arm of the Council on Foreign Relations. In the CIA, actually, started by Wild Bill Donovan. From the OSS, they went to the CIA. Walter Bedell Smith from 1945 to 53. Alan Dulles from 53 to 1961. John A. McComb. And that is from 61 to 63. And then from Richard Helms from 63 to 69. From 69 to 77, James Schlesinger, William Colby, George Bush. George Bush was ambassador to Communist China. In fact, a fellow at a party one time had told me about a situation where he was in Vietnam, actually in, I think in Laos at this particular time. They were dealing in drugs, the Central Intelligence Agency, and the suits had just come in. And this fellow was taking wounded, and they were putting him in this helicopter to fly out. When the suits arrived, the head suit was taking the wounded out of the plane. He said, "What are you doing? The lives of these men depend upon them going." He says, "No, we've got to get the heroin out." And this fellow took a gun, .45. He cocked it, and he put it at the head of the chief suit. He said, "The wounded goes out first. The heroin goes out second." Later, this man was in trial. This is in Las Vegas. And the Secret Service had come up in this trial. And they accused him of making threats against the life of the president. And this man looked back and said, he wasn't the president then, he was just another dope dealer. We're talking about George Bush. Here's a picture of George Bush and Pineapple Head and Noriega.
Okay. That was Dr. Hilda in a debate with Dr. Khalid Muhammad, and we're going to get back with that later, but I'm going to go ahead on and start. Keep in line.
Thank you. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
This is Khalid Muhammad, former national representative of Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam. Mr. Muhammad is the man who made so many of the front pages of America's newspapers with a speech at Kane College, which so many people called anti-Semitic and a lot of things. At the very least, racist. You remember the comment? He picked up the Pope's dress, and let's see what's under that dress. Here's what you said about Colin Ferguson, the man who shot a Jamaican a black male who shot six people on the Long Island train. Mr. Muhammad speaks.
where they set black inmates up in these jails and penitentiaries, and in particular there in Nassau County, and pulled all the black officers out and the black inmates so they could jump on Brother Colin Ferguson because they were mad with him for catching the Long Island train and killing all them white folks. I love Colin Ferguson. I have no official position, so I can say I love him.
You love a man who randomly killed six people on a commuter train?
I love Colin Ferguson just as much as the masses of white Americans love General Schwarzkopf, General Westmoreland, General Patton, General MacArthur, and Eisenhower. America awards her killers, and they get ribbons and stripes and bars. I'm sensitive to the pain and suffering of the loss of life on that train, but I'm one of the rebellious slaves. And so when black people stand up out of pain and suffering and frustration, I understand after 500 years.
You talk about the response of some African Americans to, for example, the book which attempts to prove that the Jews are involved in the slave trade. I'd be happy to let them see that. You talk about when white folks can't defeat you, you said in your speech at Kane, they'll always find some Negro, some boot-licking, butt-licking, buck-dancing, bamboozled, half-baked, half-fried, sissified, punkified, pasteurized, homogenized nigger that they can trot out in front of you. I would ask you, Mr. Muhammad, is Jesse Jackson a boot-licking, homogenized nigger?
To the best of his ability, I believe he tries every day to be that.
Here you are mocking Jesse Jackson at a speech. I believe this is Howard University. Roll the tape.
Oh, bootlicking, buck dancing, scratching, shuffling, messy Jesse Jackson. You keep. I am a somebody. I am a somebody. For keep hope alive. I am a somebody. I don't rightly know who the hell I am, but I am somebody.
Yeah. Are you an entertainer or are you a committed person to black people?
I'm so glad you asked that question. I believe that the liberation and salvation of the black nation must be brought about by black people gaining a thorough knowledge of self after our 500 to 6,000 year Holocaust, where we have lost over 600 million. And so I believe that that education process must be a process of two steps: inspiration and information. So I seriously give information, but black people are a people of rhythm and spirit, so I also give inspiration.
From your speech at Kane College in 1960, Chief Luthuli, the head of the ANC, received a Nobel Peace Prize, you reported to your audience, reminded them, for nonviolent struggle. Yes. Just like Mandela just received it with F.W. de Klerk. How could you stand with your oppressor and your enemy and receive the Nobel Prize for nonviolent struggle? You have, you do not support Nelson Mandela's strategy in the struggle to free black people in South Africa?
Let us first of all be very clear here, Phil. Nelson Mandela is my brother.
So
he is
Jesse
a member
Jackson.
Of the family, and so is Jesse, and Jesse is a very brilliant man. We just want him to return home and stop being used by the enemy and the oppressor against his people. Now back to Brother Nelson Mandela. And certainly we can never mention Nelson without mentioning Winnie Mandela. But Nelson Mandela's attempt at a multiracial government in South Africa after the murder of men, women, children, and babies, and the rape of South Africa, a criminal settler colony that has been established, like Israel, there in that part of the world, I cannot go along with one man, one vote. Let me say why. If someone broke into your home, Mr. Donahue, and actually bomb-rushed your home, and black boots stomped your door down, and came in and robbed and raped everyone in the household, and was able to take the wealth of your home and parlay it into an empire. This is an invader. This is an intruder. This is a murderer. This is a burglar. This is a criminal. So you have no responsibility to share your home with them after they broke in and committed the crimes that they did.
You want... You said about South Africa, we give him, that is to say white people, 24 hours to get out of town by sundown. That's all. If he won't get out of town by sundown, we'll kill every white that ain't right that's in sight in South Africa. We kill the women. We kill the children. We kill the babies. We kill the blind. We kill the cripple. We kill them all. We kill the faggot. We kill the lesbian. We kill them all. You say, why kill the babies in South Africa? Because they're going to grow up and oppress our babies, so we kill the babies. Are you seriously presenting yourself as a man interested in the future of your people with this kind of rhetoric?
I'm just as interested in the freedom of my people as I am in the self-determination or the Kujichagulia, self-development, them being self-defining, self-respecting, and self-defending. If the white man has killed millions of our people, and you cannot deny the undeniable and indisputable and irrefutable truth, fact, proof, and history of their bloodshed there in South Africa, I said it would be merciful if they would leave. I don't agree with a government, a sham government. No man walks out of prison after 27 years and becomes the president unless there's a script and a plan behind the scene to remove the economic sanctions from whites in South Africa. But no real plan for redistribution of the wealth, the Oppenheimers, the De Beers, and other there sucking the blood of our people. So I said, be merciful. Give them a period of time.
24 hours.
Truman gave the Japanese a period of time. But when they didn't comply, he dropped the bomb on men, women, children, and babies. I make no apology for that. I believe that the invasion of South Africa was an act of unprovoked war. One nation against another nation. And nations must fight for the self-determination. They had no business there, Mr. Donahue.
Yes. Would you like to see Aristide return to Haiti to his rightful, duly elected position as president?
From what I have learned and studied of President Aristide, from what I can see and those I've been privileged to talk to who are close to him, he appears to be a very sincere man. He appears to be a man who really loves our people there and wants to see our people breathe free and correct the problems that colonialism and other disruption is very definitely at the root of. However, Phil, I do not want to see my beloved brother, President Aristide, returned to Haiti by the power of a Bill Clinton. Because if Bill Clinton can help to return him there, he will always attempt to be the puppeteer who will pull the strings and try to dictate to my brother how he should carry out the affairs of government there.
Mm-hmm. Your comments appear to bespeak a political position in which you have no interest at all in reaching out and hoping and working for a multiracial community of harmony and peace. Am I correct in saying you have forsaken that ideal?
My arms are tired, Phil. We've reached out for 500 years.
Too late now.
We've faced tanks. We faced water hoses and cattle prods. Vicious dogs bit the breast of black women off in those protest marches of the civil rights movement. Vicious four-legged dogs, sicked on us by two-legged dogs, bit into the groin and the private parts of black men, women, and children. So, Mr. Donahue, I believe that the white man is absolutely disagreeable to live with in peace, and that no one has been able to get along with him nowhere on the face 196,940,000 square miles of the planet Earth.
And so you will continue this rhetoric. You will continue
these... And action.
And action. Action. What kind of action? Strategy to effect what in the United States of America? Let's start
with
us.
Well, no wise general sits with a representative of the opposition to discuss battle strategy and battle plans before the entire world. I don't think that would be wise.
Mm-hmm.
But the mission of the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the mission of my spiritual father, the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, whom I love very much, and I want to be in that number when he takes a million black men to Washington, D.C. to call for reparations and justice. Their work is a work of liberation and salvation. Their work is a work to raise the mentally and spiritually dead black man and woman after we have been robbed of our names, our language, our religion, our culture, our God, our folkways, mores, and robbed of a power, the power of our own being.
If anybody asks, to see what's under there?
This is high school
What are you trying to have?
It's an immature sort of failure to really get out of the old Beavis butthead kind of environment. Certainly you can't be proud of this kind of language that you use.
Well, if it is high school, then the Bible, listen for a second, the Bible speaks of lifting up the skirts of the gun. Oh, I'm surprised that you feel. It's a metaphor. It's symbolic language. I'm not at all interested in what is under the Pope's clothes. I'm not into that. It's a metaphor.
Let's see what's under there. But it is a metaphor to say,
let us expose the Pope. According to H. Shelton Smith, President Emeritus of Duke University, in his book entitled In His Image, quote, the Catholic Church and the Pope were directly involved in the institution of slavery. They financed slavery and gave the okay that it was good business to sell Africans. Lift up the skirts of his garment so that we can see the shame and reveal what has been hidden. But it has nothing to do with sexuality whatsoever.
Well, what do you suspect has been hidden?
I believe that it has been perpetrated before the world.
To discover what it might be.
Lift up the skirt again. I don't believe you're missing what I'm saying. Lifting up the skirt again, as the scripture says, raising the skirts of the garment, I'll say it once more for you, and only once more, has to do with revealing the history, the hidden history. When you lift up someone's garment, then you show their shame. You show up their private parts, that which they normally hide from the rest of the world. I'm not dealing with organs under the garment. I'm dealing
just
with the organ of slavery and those parts that have been kept private from the masses of the people.
We are in New York City with Khalid Muhammad, and we'll be back in just a moment. Here is just one of the comments that provoked the Anti-Defamation League to take out a full-page ad in the New York Times and other newspapers. What the ADL did essentially was publish in the New York Times some of the things that you said. Here's a part, this is an audio tape, of a part of your speech to Cain College last November that created such furor. Khalid Muhammad speaking.
The hook-nosed, bagel-eating, locks-eating, imposter perpetrating a fraud, Johnny come lately, just crawled out of the caves and hills of Europe, wanna be you.
Mm-hmm. Not presuming you haven't been asked this before, but may I ask you kindly to speak
speak to the loved ones of Schwerner and Goodman, who died with one of your brothers, Cheney, buried in a shallow grave in the South in the middle of the civil rights movement, because this black man was seen with two white Jews down there causing trouble, trying to promote the civil liberties of your people. Two Jews found in a shallow grave. I happen to have met the mother of one of these very brave people. And when she sees this, we can only speculate what must go on in her heart. You would want to say what to her?
I don't have anything to say to
you
her.
You just condemned all Jews with that observation, with this alliterative kind of Jew bashing that so excites your largely male audiences.
Well, I wonder why. It means that I speak the truth. I speak to the pain and hurt of the masses of black people.
Uh-huh.
I speak that which many of them wish they could say. That's why they cheer and applaud.
Speak to Mrs. Goodman's
and I speak
pain.
That also,
speak to
which
Mrs.
many
Goodman.
Of them only whisper behind closed doors. I think it is very arrogant to put this on the screen and for you and for others to attempt to tell me, one of the Holocaust victims of the African Holocaust, displaced in the death and decadence of the diaspora of the Western world after having been robbed and raped and murdered, to tell me how to hurt. These are strong words that you put on the screen. But you cannot tell the aggrieved and the victim. As I was talking to Brother Malik Zulu Shabazz, the young student warrior from Howard University, and we were going over this. And we said, how do they expect to tell we who have suffered so much how we should speak? When you're hurt, you'll say faggot, you'll say cracker, but you don't want to give me time to say where these terms came from and how they apply to your people here in America.
You see, this true. If it is true that I don't want to give you time to explain the etymology of these words, it is also true that you apparently don't want to respond to my question regarding the loved ones of two Jews who lost their lives to stop the diaspora of the black people.
I don't know.
Do you have any?
I don't know why they were there, and you don't know why they were there. But
really?
I must say this.
So you're wondering whether
this.
They were there for your people?
I'm not wondering at all about them.
What are you?
I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. They are too many of us for me to speak to them.
You don't want to take any time to make any particular
We've given
statement.
All the time we've been in America. Now it's time we do something for ourselves. We are the same people, Phil, that when you beat us and rearrange our eyeballs in the socket and rearrange our face and beat us and stomp us before the world, we're the same people that get up because God just made us with tender and sensitive hearts as his chosen people and say, well, can't we just get along?
The United States House of Representatives, in an unprecedented action, I don't know whether there's a precedent for the U.S. House to take its time to debate and vote on the condemnation of a private citizen, but it has done that. 435 members of the House of Representatives debating the condemnation of Mr. Muhammad. Here are two members of the House on opposing sides. Calling for the censoring of Mr. Muhammad is Congressman Lantos, followed by Congressman Abercrombie, who makes a statement in behalf of free speech. Watch this, House of Representatives.
On November 29, 1993, at Keene College in New Jersey, Mr. Khalid Mohammed, a senior representative of the Nation of Islam, delivered an outrageous and violent attack on the principles of racial, religious, and ethnic intolerance. His attempt to incite violence by preaching bigotry and hatred must be swiftly and forcefully condemned by this body.
Governmental sanction against any speech, objectionable as it may be, is always suspect. The Constitution has proven to be our strongest safeguard against the Muhammads of the world. Let us respect and revere the Constitution of the United States and vote down this resolution.
Congressman Abercrombie's position did not carry. The final vote by the House of Representatives on the matter of condemning Mr. Muhammad was 361 yay, 34 nay. You have, sir, been condemned by the United States House of Representatives. I assume you are flattered by that action.
I believe that my ancestors, I believe that the blood that cries out from the grave of my ancestors who went to an untimely death at the hands of the white wicked slave traders, I believe that they cry out, their spirit is around me, and their spirit emanates from me. And I believe that as a righteous man of God, but as a freedom fighter and a revolutionary, it is one of the greatest honors that could be paid.
And we'll be back in just a moment.
To be a part of the audience, please send a postcard for free tickets to Donahue Tickets, care of NBC, 30 Rockefeller Plaza, New York, New York, 10112. Remember, postcards only, please. Be sure to include your phone number with area code.
Yes, I have one question for the white audience that's watching this. A lot of times we're asked, they ask, what can they do to help this situation? And I feel that they should go over to their people and represent that this issue the same way this brother puts his life on the line for us. They should be doing the same thing, because otherwise it's going to be a one-sided view. They need to reach their people as well.
Yes.
What I'd like to know is, what do they say to the KKK, the skinheads, the Nazis?
All white folks support the KKK.
Well, enough of them do.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Nobody says anything about
what?
Nobody disputes the facts or his facts. His facts are right and exact, and no scholar will debate Dr. Collard, because
right.
Dr. Collard
That's
is right.
Right. Right.
I'm going to answer that later.
Okay. That was Donahue and Dr. Khalid Mohammed explaining his position. And what is interesting in that interview is, no matter what, he seemed to continue to embrace his people regardless of what kind of outside circumstances came from anyone else. And that is called that is a person who was not suffering from any type of Stockholm syndrome, having some type of feelings and becoming saddened and emotional over the harm and hurt of those who have caused you a problem, have enslaved you, killed you, your family members. And but a lot of people feel like that, especially among people of African descent. I have noticed that a lot of us, we always have this attitude, a lot of us, that we need to love everybody. My thing is this. I was always taught as a child that before you go out to save the world, have you made up your own bed yet? Before you begin to try to love someone else, have you learned everything about all the reasons why you should love you first, and why your people should come first and everybody else comes second? And I think you will discover that you also will not be suffering from any type of Stockholm syndrome. and that is someone who is embracing the murderers of his own people. And so, therefore, I just wanted to add that little bit of information and give you a little quick station break here. For those of you who would like to receive my free articles, the 14th Amendment and the Commerce Game, just send me an email at tahaka99@yahoo.com. And if you want to connect with me on Dig, MySpace, Black Panther, and stuff, and I'm all there. If you missed this broadcast, or if you just want to go back and re-listen to it, go to ancientblacksinasia.blogspot.com. That's ancientblacksinasia.blogspot.com, and you can listen to broadcasts as much as you like. We're going to go on and get the opinions of some other people in regards to this thing, whether or not we should defend ourselves, whether we should have guns. And what we're doing here is we're laying out all the facts from as many conceivable angles as we can. That way you can make an intelligent decision, because we do have people of African descent inside this country that actually feels that it is wrong to have devices to defend yourself. We're going to go on into the next segment here.
That only a dead imperialist is a good one. Now, is that the kind of language that's likely to make soldiers behave responsibly?
This is only a dramatic way of saying we are waging a struggle to overthrow the settler system.
If you look at violent interracial crime, black-white crime, there are about a million acts of violent black-white crime in a given year. And by violent, I mean rape, murder, robbery with aggravation, manslaughter. About 90% of that involves a black perpetrator, and 90% involves a white victim.
But you're half right, Larry, because as you well know, so you don't tell the whole story. The other part of the story is that I've heard you before this argument. You won't admit this.
Well,
most crimes committed against whites are committed by other whites. Most crimes committed by blacks are committed by other blacks.
Well,
what's your point?
It depends on the category of crime. Almost half.
So you're picking one or two categories.
Hold on. Almost half of certain categories of crime committed by blacks are in fact against white people. But the point is this, Tavis. When you look at the percentage of blacks in the population, blacks are committing far more crime against whites than the other way around. Way more. Look at polling data. Anti-Semitism. The good news is that in America, anti-Semitism is at an all-time low. However, in the black community, the anti-Semitic rate is almost three times higher than the non-black community.
I don't want to be on this list, but I still think, though, that does a disservice to the facts. If most crimes committed against whites are committed by whites, most crimes committed against blacks are committed by blacks, I think you're doing a disservice if you're not representing. It's intellectual dishonesty.
Almost half of the victims of black crime are, in fact, white people.
The other thing is that there's only one nigger on the planet. I never use that word. This is the first time I've used it. I don't even think that word. But there's only one nigger on the planet. And the nigger that's on the planet is the one that is destroying the water, the one that's polluting the air, the one that is exploiting people and resources. And the only nigger on the planet is the white man and the white woman. And then finally, I want to say that we need one idea. And we're not thinking about a solution to the problem. We're dealing with all these other things, but these are diversions from the solution to the problem. And we have to start to think about a solution to the problem so that these young brothers and sisters who are here now, who are 15, 16, and 17, are not here 25 years later talking about these same problems. Now, how do I know that the white people know that we are going to come up with a solution to the problem? I know it because they have retina scans, they have what they call racial profiling, DNA banks, and they're monitoring our people to try to prevent the one person from coming up with the one idea. And the one idea is how we are going to exterminate white people, because that, in my estimation, is the only conclusion I have come to. We have to exterminate white people off of the face of the planet to solve this problem. Now, I don't care whether you clap or not, but I'm saying to you that we need to solve this problem because they are going to kill us. And I will leave on that. So we have to just set up our own system and stop playing and get very serious and not be diverted from coming up with a solution to the problem. And the problem on the planet is white people.
Okay. We're going to go to the phone lines now. And I see area code 904. And let's see here. Area code 904, could you tell us who you are and where you're calling from?
Area code 904. Hey, calling from Jacksonville, Florida. This is Umar Sharif.
Brother Umar. Okay, my brother. Peace. Ladies and gentlemen, we have Brother Umar Sharif. And the brother has the gift shop here in Jacksonville, Florida, the bookstore down here on Pearl Street. And for those of you who are listening to this broadcast from Jacksonville, he's right down here. I've printed books of incense and lotions and stuff for you. What's your comment, brother? You have a comment or question?
Well, first of all, I want to applaud the effort that, you know, you and I talk a lot, and you're doing a good job, man. You're staying in the trenches, and I have to admire and respect that, and I support you. My comments is that, you know, in reference to the program that you say you were going to do tonight in terms of people having the right to defend themselves, mm-hmm. and that's very, very, very serious issue because of the fact that we don't become so weak in our community wherein that, you know, we don't have no way to defend ourselves.
Okay.
And you know, what make America very strong and very powerful is that America has military might, and that's the respect that America has in terms of other nations, its fields, its technology, and its muscle. And we used to have that in the 60s with people like Huey Newton and the Panther Party and Imam Jamil, Kwame Ture. We had that. And then all of a sudden, man, we just feel like the only way that we can survive is turn the other cheek. And I don't accept that. I think that you have the right to defend yourself and your property, as Malcolm said, by any means necessary. So I don't go along with turning the other cheek. I think we got to have some training going on where we can defend ourselves and learn the art of war and learn how to use certain weapons, man, so that we can save ourselves.
Okay, well, brother, I'm in absolute agreement with you in that, and I do think that we should not only own weapons, but we should have adequate ammunition. And I think that the family members in your home should know how to use these weapons safely. And for not only for self-defense when a serious problem arises, but also for hunting and gathering food. And this is something that I had many uncles and my grandfather, and they all had guns, and they all protected their home. There was never a time when anyone just come up in there and just took over anything, because they knew in the neighborhood that these brothers here, they had protection. And I think it is naive for men today that get in positions where they think, okay, well, I'm in the church now, and I'm not going to need that. We don't understand that a weapon serves more than just self-defense. It serves other purposes as well, and including the gathering of food. So I think when you have that, I think that you have overall protection. In a device to to provide whatever needs that you have and to protect yourself by whatever means that you find necessary. So I'm in 100% agreement with you on that.
Yeah, just one other thing. We should be very, very conscious to know that these gun shows are not just put on just to be put on. I think that myself, and I go to a lot of them, they are actually really preparing white folks to do get themselves prepared. There's going to be, as Malcolm said, there's going to be a civil war in the streets over these jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're thinking that white folks is going to give up their job for us, we got another thing coming.
Well,
and it's
going
to come down, and we need to prepare ourselves. We need to have a survival, learn what it is to survive, and to put our mind in a survival mode and always be, as we were taught in the days, to always walk your post in a perfect manner, keeping always on alert. So I just wanted to just, you know, let you know, Brother Tahaka, I'm with you 100%. I thought that this program was about the most program that really brought me on because of the fact that I always thought like that. And I think that as African-Americans, especially in the South, I never seen black folks as so undefensive. I've ever seen in my history that I've been here in this city and traveled. This is the one of the main cities that I see that's very, very undefensive, man. And we got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, well, I'm in agreement with that. I've pretty much seen the same thing throughout the city. I've seen men who they don't have any protection. They have women, and they have quite a few children in the home, but there's no protection. I mean, it's just no protection, and I believe that that's just a fundamental part of our life being inside the United States of America, which is an armed camp. I mean,
right.
I've been to the gun show as well, and I mean, Europeans are up in there, and they're purchasing guns by the armloads.
That's right.
And I mean, they say they live in gun shops. And,
right.
But we go, you know, when we go in some place, we go in there and pawn something sell something to get some money, but we don't understand, and we are sitting back and thinking, maybe, well, maybe by some hook or crook, something different will happen.
Right.
I certainly appreciate you calling in, brother. I'm going to go ahead on and click on into the next plug.
And, okay, my brother. You stay strong. Appreciate you, brother. Keep up the good work.
All right. That was Brother Omar Sharif. And he's right here locally in Jacksonville, Florida. He owns the bookstore down there, Al Salam's bookstore. And he has plenty of conscious books. He has incense. He has oil, perfumes and stuff. And as well as many other products, lotions and stuff as well. And he also have clothing and purses and stuff. So you should stop by. He's right down here on Pearl Street here in Jacksonville, Florida. I don't have his information right in front of me. But if you would like to inquire about this location or what have you, just give me a call at area code 904-303-9061, and I'll get that information to you so you can get on down there and see the brother. I'm going to go into the next plug now.
May 31st and June 1st, 2010, was the 89th anniversary of the worst civil unrest in the history of America, not counting the Civil War. It was called the Tulsa Race Riot, and over 300 people were killed. Much has been written, and many stories have been told about what really happened. We must set the record straight. First thing that you must know if you really care is that it was not a race riot, but a race massacre. Stop calling it a riot like you were there. Innocent people, men, women, and children killed everywhere. It was a setup, a scheme, or a plan.
to destroy all of Little Africa or gray with land. It began on May 31st, 1921.
Go straight on into this segment.
Traditional three or four times, it turned over 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 times. That was legitimate and illegitimate monies to be made that fueled that economy. So my community was the Vegas of the 20. It was roaring.
I can remember when I was a child that the Ku Klux Klan, and there were probably, in my opinion, couple thousand of them that would all robe up with their hoods on and their gowns and women and men and children. They had little children, maybe 3 feet high. They were all robed up and holding on to somebody's hand. They would march too. Usually they would form up on about the 7th Street and Maine in there someplace, and then the police would clear all of the cars off of Main Street, and they would march and they would fill the street from curb to curb, and it seemed like thousands of them. There might have been 2,000, I don't know, I don't remember.
We used to go up and watch the Ku Klux Klan in their rally on top of Standpipe Hill, and they were in their white robes and their pointed cap attire, and we used to just watch them. They had their torches burning and having a meeting. We knew not to get too close to them.
The Klan was founded in 1865 to intimidate Southern blacks in the post-Civil War South. The Reign of Terror lasted 15 years, but as the movement died out, a legend, if not a lie, remained. Aging Civil War veterans told heroic stories of how the Klan had saved the South from domination by Negroes and Northern carpetbaggers. By 1915, there was no Klan in America. 3 months later, an extraordinary event took place that would resurrect the Klan and its legend. The event was the release of a pioneering motion picture, D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation. It was based on a best-selling book called The Klansman. In many cases, Klan recruitment ads ran next to movie ads. Birth of a Nation played to 50 million people, approximately half of the population of the United States. It played across Oklahoma with a tremendous run in Tulsa.
The Birth of a Nation stimulated the organization of the Ku Klux Klan, which in turn maintained a high profile and stirred up many whites to acts of recrimination and of savagery in this period.
When you have thousands of white men coming back from World War I, bringing back Souvenir, Lewis, Spandau, and Browning submachine guns, and a variety of other weapons that they brought back from the battlefield, and then they can't find jobs, and the power structure within the city at that time, as was occurring in other cities, would enlist them in the Ku Klux Klan and blame their problems on Jews, African Americans, and Catholics. It was a simple answer to a complex problem for simple people. Meanwhile, they could stand in downtown Tulsa and look at the mansions in Little Africa in the Black Wall Street and seethe.
It was a typical Monday morning for a 19-year-old black man named Dick Rowland. He worked as a bootblack in the downtown area. Because there was no restroom facilities, Rowland had permission to use the restroom on the top floor of the Drexel building. In order to reach the top floor, he had to use the elevator.
Dick Rowland didn't look down when he went to get on the elevator, and therefore, because of the unevenness of the two floors, he stumbled. Started falling, and he reached out to keep break his fall and touched his operator, and she hollered rape. And so they arrested, the police came and arrested Dick Rowland about 10 o'clock in the morning. And that afternoon, the Tribune came out and told what happened at the in the Rue building. And after they told what was going to happen, then they said, it looks like there will be a lynching in Tulsa tonight.
The newspaper described Rowland as Diamond Dick and told of an attempted assault upon a poor orphan girl who worked as an elevator operator to pay her way through college. The article said that she had scratches on her hands and face. In fact, she was not an orphan. She had deserted her husband in Kansas City, had been served with divorce papers in Tulsa 2 months before. And she was neither scratched nor had torn clothes.
The real incident isn't the incident in the elevator. The real incident is what happens over the offices of the Tulsa Tribune, which was the city's daily afternoon newspaper. And we know there were a couple articles in it that talked about what happened at the Drexel. One was a front page article that said something like, "Nab Negro for attacking girl in elevator." But there was a second article, might have been an editorial, that we think was called "To Lynch Negro Tonight." We don't know really what it said, but we do know from white sources, from black sources, from government officials and others, that there was an article there suggesting that a lynch mob should gather downtown and the lynch stick rolling.
Talk of a lynching was prevalent throughout the city. And by evening, white crowds began to form around the courthouse. A burning cross was visible on Standpipe Hill, which overlooked North Tulsa and Greenwood. The sheriff took the elevator to the jail, located on the top floor of the courthouse, and set up a barricade. In Greenwood, it was believed that a lynching was imminent. And mob rule without legal consequences was not without precedent in Tulsa. A few months before, a lynch mob had taken accused killer one Ray Belton from the Tulsa jail. A mile-long procession of cars escorted him to a tree on a county road where he was lynched. Local police officers directed traffic. 3 months later, in the town of Holdenville, 70 miles away, a white mob took a black man from the county jail, hanged him from a telephone pole, and riddled his body with bullets. He was accused of attacking a white woman. In Wagner, 30 miles from Tulsa, another lynching took place.
A white man down in Wagner, Oklahoma, had him ask a colored girl for sex. She told him her price. He had sex and he didn't want to pay her. He didn't pay her. She took out a knife and cut his throat and killed him. So they arrested her. They lynched her. And then they drug her body up and down Main Street of Wagner, Oklahoma. And the Negroes in the community had decided there will not be a lynching in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
In Oklahoma, it is not considered a crime for a man to kill a Negro. In recent years, there have been many lynchings in Oklahoma. There is yet to be chronicled the instance where any individual has paid a legal penalty or where an officer has been removed from office for failure to protect the life of his prisoners from criminal violence. It is perfectly safe at any time and at any place for any considerable number of men together to take a prisoner from the hands of an officer and inflict the penalty of death. Carlos Weekly, June 1921.
Most of the news that people received came from their newspapers. It's incredible to look at the content of those newspapers and realize that it was a constant barrage of articles appearing concerning lynchings of black people. This was over and over and over again. In fact, two black people a week were being lynched in America at this time.
The evening being a pleasant one, my little girl had not retired but was watching the people from the window. Occasionally she would call to me, "Mother, look at the cars full of people." I would reply, "Baby, not disturb me when I read." Finally, she said, "Mother, I see men with guns." Then I ran to the window and looked out. There I saw many people gathered in little squads, talking excitedly. Going downstairs to the street, I was told of the threatened lynching and that some of our group were going to give added protection to the boy. I am told that this little bunch of black men marched up to the jail where there were already over 500 white men gathered, and that this number will soon swell to over 1,000. Someone fired a stray shot, and to use the expression of General Grant, all hell broke loose.
On Main Street, right in front of the biggest picture palace. His falling brought the crowd to a halt. It just stood and looked at him. Three or four ambulances clanged down to the place, but the crowd turned on them and showed their guns. One said, "Don't touch the blankety blank." The ambulance workers didn't.
didn't quite know what to do, so they turned off their engines and just stood there, blocking the street. Then there was a whoop a block away. Some of the Negroes had tried to organize and get their friend. The crowd surged forward, trampling the man on the sidewalk who was about dead. He lay writhing on the sidewalk under a billboard from which smiled winsomely the face of Mary Pickford, America's sweetheart.
The atmosphere was festive as the police department commissioned 500 special deputies. These could best be described as Klan deputies. The only prerequisite was that they must be white. Most were not even asked their names or addresses. One black man was erroneously sworn in.
It occurred to me I could get sworn in as one of the special deputies. It was easy. My skin was apparently white, and that was enough. After some 50 or 60 of us had been sworn in, a villainous-looking man remarked casually, even with a note of happiness in his voice, "Now you can go out and shoot any nigger you see, and the law will be behind you."
The Ku Klux Klan mob, having largely been made up of veterans, began to militarily organize themselves. And they divided down into squads and ran a skirmish line along Archer.
After watching the men unload on First Street, where we could see them from our windows, we heard such a buzz and noise that on running to the door to get a better view of what was going on, the sight our eyes beheld made our poor hearts stand still for a moment. There was a great shadow in the sky, and upon a second look, we discerned that this cloud was caused by fast-approaching airplanes. It then dawned upon us that the enemy had organized in the night and was invading our district, the same as the Germans invaded France and Belgium. Looking south out of the window of what then was the Woods building, we saw carloads of men with rifles unloading up near First Street. Then the truth dawned upon us that our men were fighting in vain to hold their dear Greenwood, Mary Parish.
Whites were given a signal by a whistle, and the outrage took place. All of this happened while innocent Negroes were slumbering and did not have the least idea they would fall victims to such brutality. At the sound of another whistle, more than a dozen aeroplanes went up and began to drop turpentine balls on the Negro residences, while 5,000 whites with machine guns and other deadly weapons fired in all directions. Negro men, women, and children began making haste to flee to safety, but to no avail, as they were met on all sides with volleys of shot. They were killed in great numbers as they ran, trying to flee to safety. Torchlights were used to burn up the Negro settlement, and in the meantime, they used large trucks loading up pianos, Victrolas, and other articles that were left in the Negro homes. A.H.
Back trucks up to the vacated Negro homes and loaded everything moved and of value. Every bit of money found on their persons was taken. Masonic rings were removed from the fingers, watches and chains from their persons. In fact, everything of a material nature, preparatory to the cruel initiation which had not yet ended, was taken from them. And so, penniless, in a destitute condition, they were corralled first one place and another. G.A. Gray.
Once they framed that skirmish line, they had marched into the north side of the downtown area, and they shot everybody they could find. They burned every home, but not before looting it first. They burned every business. They burned every car. They burned everything. Systematically. Block by block, house by house. They went on.
Surgeon and past president of the State Medical Association, Dr. A.C. Jackson, was shot by a white teenager as he held his hands above his head. He was not killed instantly. His body was thrown into a truck and he was dumped at the convention center, where after hours of suffering without medical attention, he bled to death.
Cars began to drive slowly along the street. Cars driven by the sort of men who wear their caps backward, visors down their necks, probably not to interfere with their rifle gaze. And the niggers in these houses, they would shout. The gaping children were called in hastily from the curbs. Didn't seem a very educational sight. Not a very safe one. After the first car, so people sent their servants down in the cellar or up in the attic and waited.
Then the horde of ruffians went down Detroit, looting those beautiful homes of everything valuable and burning them. The machine guns just shattered the walls of the homes. The fire department came out and protected the white homes on the west side of the street. Men and women with torches and women with shopping bags continued their looting and burning Negro homes.
My mother saw some white people coming toward our house, and she put us under the bed when she saw them coming. My older sister got under first, and then it was my younger sister, and then my brother, and then they pulled me under the bed. Now, by this time, the people were coming in. They had torches in their hands. We could see their feet from under the bed. And one stepped on my finger. And as I went to scream, my sister put her hand over my mouth. I don't know what. I don't know today as to what would have happened had they heard us under the bed. But they came in and they set the curtains on fire and set our house on fire and then went out the door, and my mother got us from under the bed. I will always remember that on this day I live.
There was the son of a cook in our street. Around 9 o'clock, the man he worked for came and asked for Hattie. He was in a car with some other men. It seemed that the boy thought he ought to get to his job. Before he knew it, he'd been caught in the fighting around the railroad tracks and crawled under a freight car to hide. Someone went in after him and shot him with a pistol. Now that things were quieting down a little, he was lying in the town hall where the militia were assembling the blacks. But his employer was afraid he wouldn't live many more hours. If Hattie wanted to see the boy, he said, he would take her down and look out for her. But she was afraid to go. He couldn't blame her, really. Some of the house Negroes who had allowed themselves to be put in those wandering cars and escorted to the safety of the town hall had been shot at as they drove through the streets. It wasn't the ride an old woman wanted to undertake, even to see her boy alive. The boy's boss understood. He went back himself and got a doctor and stayed with the boy till he died.
The burning of that flesh, he could smell. It was horrible. And then those crosses burning up on the reservoir hill, which up at that time there's no homes up there.
About 7 o'clock, the white home guards came for the men. Then they took the women and children, promising them safety. After they had the homes vacated, one bunch of whites would come in and eat. Even women with shopping bags would come in, open drawers, take every kind of finery from clothing to silverware and jewelry. Men were carrying out the furniture, cursing as they did so, saying, "These damn Negroes have better things than a lot of us white people."
I stayed until my home was caught on fire. Then I ran to the hillside where there were throngs of white people, women, men and children, even babies, watching and taking snapshots of the proceedings of the mob. Some remarked that the city ought to be sued for selling them damn niggas' property so close to the city. One woman noticed the First Baptist Church, which is a beautiful structure located near a white residential district. And she said, "Yonder is a nigger church. Why ain't they burning it?" The reply was, "It's in a white district."
I saw the bombs dropping and the church explode. The six airplanes that I saw flying over Standpipe Hill and dropping the bombs on Mount Zion Baptist Church.
Burned that church, and it just completed 40 days. And it was burned. The white church on 4th Street was a frame church. Our church was better than the white people's church.
This church was only 40 days old. It was truly a symbol of black prosperity, and it was burnt to the ground, allegedly because ammunition was being stored in the basement or some such nonsense.
People were seen to flee from their burning homes, some with babes in their arms and leading crying, excited children by the hand, others old and feeble, all fleeing to safety. Yet, seemingly, I could not leave. I walked as one in a horrible dream. By this time, my little girl was up and dressed, but I made her lie down on the duvet in order that the bullets must penetrate it before reaching her. By this time, a machine gun had been installed in the granary and was raining down bullets on my section. Mary Parrish.
The most horrible scenes of this occurrence was to see women dragging their children while running to safety, and the dirty white rascals firing at them as they ran. Some of them were pursued for more than 12 or 15 miles, and some never returned. Negro hospitals with numbers of sick were burned, and many people perished in the flames, not being able to get to a place of safety. Women were chased from their homes, naked, with clothes in their hands, and volleys of shots fired at them as they were fleeing. Some with babies in their arms. D.H.
As I neared Standpipe Hill, I could see homes on Easton and Detroit burning, and also discovered that the enemy had located on the hill and that our district was entirely surrounded. We thought that we were leaving the fire behind, but found that our danger was increasing, for a machine gun was located on the hillside.
They came to the door, they had machine guns up there, and he was manning the machine gun, and he and his companions, they were shooting down on the people.
They had machine guns up there, shooting at us. My husband and I, when we came out, they were shooting at us. We didn't get any shots. They killed one of our fine doctors.
I can never forget a family who started out and had the misfortune to lose one wheel off their wagon and therefore had to get out and walk. In that numbers was a mother and a father with a 6-month-old infant. Such a fine and healthy baby. The father would run along and carry it a while, when the mother would take it until she was tired out. When they both were just about exhausted, the father cried out, "Will someone help us?"
Mrs. Rosa Davis Skinner, who told about the night of the riot when it broke out on Greenwood, she was asleep. Her husband awakened her and said, "Wife, come on, there's a riot on." And they left fleeing, she in her gown and house shoes, and joined with a neighbor next door who had had a stillborn baby early in the day. They were going to bury the baby the next day, put it in a little shoebox. And Mrs. Skinner said that while they were running, mobsters shooting at them, bullets zinging at them, people shoving and bumping into each other, this lady dropped that little shoebox. And she got down on her hands and knees to try to find it. and she couldn't. And her husband just dragged her away, said, well, you're going to get killed. We've got to go. And he dragged her away, and they never found that little baby. This lady wept when she told me that. She was 98 years old, and that had been 75 years early, and she wept and said, I often wonder what happened to that poor little baby. We both wept.
We came out after several shots were fired into the house by the mob. Two or three whites thrust guns in each man's
surgeon and past president of the
face inside and took him downstairs. As I neared the bottom of the steps, I was met by a man who very unkindly treated me. Seeing a man with hands raised, he came up to the blind side and struck me in the jaw, after which I was questioned and my money taken. The worst thing of all was being humiliated before little boys between the ages of 12 and 16 years, knowing these youngsters would grow up to try the same thing when they matured that others tried, but with less success, I am hoping. J.C. Latimer.
One of the classic photos that comes from the riot is that of a perhaps 15, 16-year-old, probably would be referred to in those days as a hooligan, strutting proudly in front of the camera with the burning and terrible circumstances in the background, puffing a cigar, carrying not one but two firearms. As you look at that picture and you think of what's going on around him, you can't help but hope that he will be taught a lesson about life's justice.
The certainty that many blacks had that whites took their furniture, took their clothes, took various other personal possessions, and used them, and then, having taken those things for their use, then they burned and bombed the black part of town.
It was a surprise. And they came over here and burned our homes, stole our clothes. Some of our people had to take their own clothes over white people right here in Tulsa.
The heavy air was soaked with the scent of honeysuckle, as extravagant and lavishly unreal as was the gunfire. We'd been in this prairie country a year. It proved always surprising. An acrid underhint of burnt powder began to cut through the perfume of the flowers.
Tulsa's newspapers described the event as a military adventure. The black people defending their homes were described as the enemy. Gun-toting white men were referred to as riflemen or soldiers, and blacks were termed snipers. The mob, it was called a volunteer army. Blacks with guns were called a mob. Marauding whites were called patrols. At approximately 9:15 a.m., the National Guard troops from Oklahoma City arrived by train.
In all my experience, I've never witnessed such a scene. 25,000 whites, armed to the teeth, were ranging through the city in utter and ruthless defiance of every concept of law and righteousness. Motor cars bristling with guns swept through the city, their occupants firing at will. General Charles Barrett.
Fanny was our laundress. She lived in Greenwood with an ancient uncle who'd been a messenger in a bank for 20 years. They knew there was trouble, of course, but the mob had missed them so far. Uncle Zach had never been late to the bank, and he trusted white folks. He thought maybe if he put on his uniform and they saw it, he put it on and started out to work. Someone shot him at the corner. Fanny could see him lying there. She didn't dare go out and get him. Mob was so close.
As North Tulsa burned and its citizens murdered and arrested, the guard set up camp and began to prepare a breakfast. When a local citizen urged the commander to take some action to save property and lives, he was arrested. Martial law was declared at 11:29 a.m.
The Ku Klux Klan, realizing that they were now up against an organized military force, withdrew out of the area and dissipated back into their neighborhoods. It was very much like a guerrilla operation where you could no longer tell who were the combatants because they weren't wearing uniforms, and now they were part of the civilian society.
detention areas were set up at a local park, the convention center, and the baseball park. Every African American had to fill out and carry an identification card, which had to be signed by a white employer and approved by a local official. If approved, the prisoner was given a ribbon that he or she had to wear. The ribbon read, Police Protection. Failure to wear the ribbon resulted in immediate arrest and confinement. A black person could only be released from detention if he or she was vouched for by a white person.
About 11 o'clock, they took my invalid mother supposedly to the convention hall for safety. Upon entering the convention hall, I failed to find my mother, so I went in search of her. I found my mother at North Methodist Church. I tried to get a pass to send her away, but failed to get one. She remained unconscious for 2 weeks and passed away. I feel that this damnable affair has ruined us all. Carrie Kinlaw.
We hadn't heard from my father. And although I was 6 years old, I remember quite well the anxiety that all of us felt. Where's my daddy? Where's my husband? Mother would say, and so forth. And so we had a period of agonizing waiting, and that was an awful, awful experience. And it was several days, I don't know how many, in the absence of telephones and radios and that sort of thing. We didn't know. We had no way of finding out. And so after what seemed to have been an endless period of time, we received a letter from my father saying that he was all right. He told us that he had been in detention at Convention Hall, and that he had nothing except what he had on his back.
The prisoners, mostly women and children and the elderly, were marched through the streets with their hands above their heads. The stress, heat, and exertion resulted in the rise of premature births. Before the day was over, every black person in the city was killed, wounded, arrested, or placed in confinement.
Actually hid many of the African-American domestics who worked for them at great jeopardy to them. If a white family during that riot had been found to have hidden an African-American, at the very least, the white family would have been lashed.
Terrified black people fled the city to other communities.
After reaching this home, the crowd thrown there was too large to supply them out of a pail, so a wash tub was drafted into service and pride cast to the wind. We were so famished and our lips parched, the children crying for a drink, that this was the best tasting water we could remember of having tasted. Mary Parrish.
We had an engineer for the Frisco live behind us, and he would give us a day by day how these people were walking down the railroad coming toward Claremore, and then coming toward Chelsea, then coming toward Veneta. They were just like the rest of the hobos that came to our back door. And they had lots of them with baby buggies, no men at all. All women, lots of old women.
On and on we went toward the section line. the crowd growing larger and larger. The question on every lip when a newcomer from town would arrive was, how far had they burned when you left town? After we had gone several miles, we began to see automobile loads of men with guns going east ahead of us. We wondered where they were going, but we were not destined to wander for long. But as we neared the aviation fields, we saw their destination. The planes were out of the sheds, all in readiness for flying, and these men with high-powered rifles were getting into them. We saw several men leaving the field, going to the house, returning with guns, and heading towards Tulsa. After we had traveled many miles into the country and was turning to find our way to Claremont, we looked up the road and saw Race Lady coming toward us. My lady friend and I went to meet her. She advised us to not to try to pass through a little adjoining town.
There was a group of black people that were trying to escape, women, children, and old people, like we were trying to escape from this thing. We're going up the railroad tracks that went by that hill up there in Collinsville. Said that a group of black people came by that hill trying to escape, and somebody thought that they were being attacked and invaded, and apparently they began shooting and killing a whole bunch of those poor folks.
The airplanes continued to watch over the fleeing people like great birds of prey watching for victims. Although we were over 13 miles from Tulsa, we could, at about 10 p.m., see the smoke rising from the ruins. The next morning, we were informed that Greenwood had been burned. It was then that I shed my first tears. A truck arrived for us about 9 o'clock, and we started for Tulsa. We did not enter through our section, but we were brought through the white section. Can you imagine the humiliation of coming in like that, with many doors thrown open, watching you pass? Some with pity, and others with smiles.
And when a bunch of the colored folks that they were marching down Elgin, I would see them coming, and I'd kept my BB gun under the front porch at that time, and I would run down and grab the BB gun and stick the barrel out through the lattice work and pop the National Guardsmen. And of course they'd bounce like this and look around, and of course I was careful enough that I wasn't going to hit anybody in the head or anything like that.
These two brothers, and they're the youngest two, they were kind of smart alecky, and they thought, you know, they'd stir up a riot or stink or something. And I can remember standing behind them and crying when my dad just hauled off and backhanded one of them in the back of the head because he was going to take a gun. And he wasn't going to shoot at the people. He was going to shoot up in the air. And I remember my crying and saying, begging him not to do it. And my dad, you know, was telling me he wasn't going to do that to those people. They was only trying to get away themselves.
Soon we reached the Black District, which was so beautiful and prosperous looking when we left. There we found to be piles of bricks, ashes, and twisted iron representing years of toil and savings. We were horror-stricken, but could not shed a tear. At that hour, we mistrusted every person having a white face or blue eyes.
which he had built a crate on the back to carry the greyhounds in. And he took that crate off when he left the greyhounds, wherever it was he left them, at some kennel or other, and just had a plain pickup truck. And the police saw his truck, and they told him to call bodies, dead bodies, to wherever they were taking them. I don't know where they took them.
And I saw these two truckloads of bodies, dead bodies. They were Negroes with their arms and legs sticking out, you know, through the slats. And it frightened me so, but I kept thinking of them in terms of dolls. On the top of the very, very top of the pile of bodies was a little boy just about my age. And his head flipped over like that. And he looked at me, his mouth was open. And he was in the brown pants and a blue shirt. And just looked like he'd been frightened to death. And so I screamed that Jesse came in, but by that time the two trucks had passed on.
After black Tulsans were incarcerated, curiosity seekers, looters, and souvenir hunters casually strolled through the smoldering ruins.
Well, I had a friend, a girlfriend, and one day after the riot had subsided, or possibly was still, they were still protecting and giving the colored people sanctuary. Well, she came out and she had a package of spearmint gum, Wrigley spearmint gum, and perhaps there were 40 or 50 packages of gum in the little square box, about so square and maybe 2 inches deep, and she was passing the gum out to all the kids in the neighborhood. And of course, we asked, where did you get it? And she said, old daddy got it over in Niggertown, which was a clear indication that, that white people looted the colored people over in the Greenwood area. When they doubted about it, of course, we didn't think anything about it. We just took the gum and chewed it.
Martial law was less than benevolent. Field Order Number 3 prohibited the holding of funerals at churches. But in reality, this prohibition pertained to black funerals only. White funerals went on as usual.
Overnight, these people had nothing. And they had to start over again. A person who had office and clients or patients, our customers, had nothing. And the people that were his clients and or their clients and patients and customers had nothing. And so it was extremely difficult for them to get on their feet.
It was pathetic when you think about it. Out of all of our 7 years, as you know, I said, my husband and I lost more than anybody in North Tulsa because we lost 7 years of our money in one night. And we had altogether 10 different business places for rent. Today I'm paying rent.
Few black Tulsans had insurance. And those who did had clauses which voided the policies in case of a riot. Those making a claim had to prove that the city or state government was negligent in protecting their property. An impossible burden because the victors had already begun to rewrite the history and insulate themselves from blame. An all-white grand jury placed the blame for the Holocaust squarely on the black population. Also blaming the black population was Tulsa's white churches, the Chamber of Commerce, and of course Tulsa's white newspapers.
In this old nigger town, there are a lot of bad niggers, and a bad nigger is about the lowest thing that walks on 2 feet. Give a bad nigger his booze, his dope, and a gun, and he thinks he can shoot up the world. And all these four things were to be found in nigger town: booze, dope, bad niggers, and guns. Tulsa Tribune makes no apology to the police commissioners or to the mayor of this city for having pled with them to clean up the cesspools in this city. Tulsa Tribune, June 4th, 1921.
Incredibly, after all the yellow journalism that had been published
at the time about the incident and prior to the incident by white-owned newspapers. The one indictment returned by the grand jury of a newspaper was against Mr. A.J. Smitherman, one of the most influential black citizens in Tulsa, owner of the black newspaper. And that comes after his offices, his newspaper offices, were destroyed and burned in the riot. He left Tulsa and never returned.
Cities across America offered assistance.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to stop here, and I'm going to do part two of this broadcast Saturday evening, and we'll finish up and do a full two-hour broadcast so that we can make a decision on whether or not people of African descent inside the United States should even own guns. And but before we make that decision, let's get all the facts, and let's gather all the information that we can so that we can make a sound decision. And I'm going to go ahead on now and close this broadcast out, and we'll pick up where we left off at this evening, and we'll do that Saturday evening at 7 p.m., so you all tune in. I've been your host, Tohaka Manuel Bay, and until next time.
Do-do-do-do-do-do.